that the Lord, either through me or in spite of me, will give you the message that he knows you need. I'm going to preach to you this morning what's known as the greatest sermon ever preached. Now, don't worry, it's not being preached by me, but I'm going to preach about it. I want to preach to you from the Sermon on the Mount this morning. The Sermon on the Mount is, in my opinion, clearly the greatest sermon because of the range of concepts it covers and things that it guides us and directs us to do. It's out of the book of Matthew, chapters 5, chapter 6, and chapter 7. And I'm not going to cover all of it, but I do want to cover a few highlights through there. But let's talk generally about it first. You'll have a lot of people that will tell you that Sermon on the Mount shows you the path to salvation. It'll show you the path to salvation, but not eternal salvation. It's a guidepost for us to live in this life. It's a great instruction book on how we live day to day and survive this world. All throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus uses the terms the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God in some of the other gospels, but in Matthew, he calls this the kingdom of heaven. Do this and you can enter the kingdom of heaven. Do this and you can see the kingdom of heaven. That's not talking about eternal heaven. That's talking about the kingdom of heaven that we can be in today if we do what he tells us to do. It's been a while, but I spoke maybe a couple years ago on the 12th chapter of 2 Corinthians, where John talks about seeing into the third heaven, and that was actually paradise. That's the eternal heaven that we know about. I don't know how many heavens there are, but we know from John that there's at least three. And I spoke on that, the third heaven being the eternal heaven. That means there's two prior to that. And I'll summarize real quickly. I've talked about, heaven is a spiritual relationship with the Lord. And the third heaven or paradise will be when we're in eternal heaven. And that, of course, is the greatest relationship we have with the Lord. First two, in my opinion, I talked about them and supported them and documented them at that time. The first heaven was the relationship that God had with the Jewish people. They were his chosen people. They had a special relationship with him. And when they followed what he instructed them and what he commanded them to, they got to enjoy a sense of heaven. They had a special relationship and they were blessed. They were blessed in that first heaven. We know that was in the Old Testament. The Old Testament was placed by the New Testament, and we have a new covenant because the Jewish people could not follow the commandments. They didn't have the ability really to follow because of their very human nature in them. So Jesus came and brought us the new covenant, and with that he brought us a new relationship with the Lord. And we're told that over in Hebrews where the Lord tells us, I'm making a new covenant, not the old one that I had in back in the days of nation of Israel, but my people in which I will put my laws into their heart, I will write them into their minds, I will be to them a God, they shall be to me a people. And no longer shall anybody go out and teach their fellow man, their fellow brethren to know the Lord. They'll all know me from the least to the greatest. The Lord says, I'll put myself into their hearts. I'm in charge of that. My job up here is not to put the Lord into your heart and teach you to know the Lord. That's the Lord's job. My job is to come and minister to preach to those who the Lord has already touched their hearts, put themselves in their heart. This is the kingdom of heaven. When we come and we read the Bible and we come to church and we enjoy and the Lord's with us and blesses us, then we're in the kingdom of heaven. And that's what he's talking about in Matthew. This is the second heaven, I believe, out of those three. It's a better relationship with the Lord than the people of Israel had. The Lord has revealed so much more to us. Apostle Paul tells us that in Ephesians about the Lord has revealed to us a lot of the mysteries that our forefathers didn't know back in the Old Testament. He's told us more how his sovereign grace works, and we get to enjoy that. We get to read about it. We get to study it. We get to understand it. And if we follow and do what he says, then we get to enjoy and enter into that kingdom of heaven. That's not talking about eternal salvation. If you're allowed to enter into the kingdom of heaven because of your worship service, that means you already have a place reserved for you in that third heaven, the paradise. So that's what we're talking about. He's talking about how we can act and behave and do and the things that we do and the manner that we go about them doing them. We can enjoy the kingdom of heaven today. That's what he's trying to talk to us about. So I want to speak to you from the Sermon on the Mount and what it can do for us today. And I'm going to go through and just cover some of the highlights of it. Before I go there, I want to tell you a story. And it's going to be a little unrelated. And this is a true story. It's a little bit unrelated, but I hope I can tie them together in a minute. Back when my wife and I, we waited a long time before we have kids. Everybody had given up on us, I think. We waited 17 years after we were married, before we started having children. And we had our son first and then a daughter second. And Ray is here this morning, my daughter. But one of the goals that my wife and I had, and we talked about, we waited a long time. We had a long time to talk about this. We wanted to raise up our kids and make sure they understood the value of books and the importance of reading. We both viewed that very highly. Of course, we were both attorneys and went to law school, and we understood the concept of reading and being educated and knowing those and how much that helps you. It's like reading the Bible, how much that will help you understand this kingdom of heaven. But we committed we were going to teach our kids to read from a very early age. So my wife went out. She was in charge of doing that and went out and bought books and bought some of the best books and illustrations and had good morals. And we would read those books to them. And, of course, there for a while, my wife didn't work, and she stayed home with the kids. Our first child, firstly, Reed, stayed home with him. And then I would come in the afternoon, and I wanted to participate too. So my job was, our agreement was, I'd come in at nighttime, and I'd read the books to the kids at nighttime. And, you know, you read them a lot softer books to get them, you know, in a good mood to go to get them sleepy before they go to bed, you know. And so you'd read, she picked out a lot of books that were good for reading them to get them sleepy and get them calmed down so they'd go to sleep. So I'd be working all day, and then I'd come in the afternoon, late in the afternoon, and have supper. And then I would go in and read and started off with my son Reed, read the books to him, and I'd be reading to him. And again, she'd pick these out to get him calmed down to go to bed at night. She'd be reading them, and then while I was reading that, well, she would go in. That'd be one of her chance she could watch TV. And we had a satellite dish at the time, and we got West Coast programming. We got the ABC, NBC, CBS on the West Coast. So she could go in at 9 or 10 o'clock at night and watch the shows on that time zone that were our 7 and 8 o'clock here that she had missed. So she enjoyed doing that, catching some of the primetime television at nighttime. But she'd be in there. I'd be starting reading the book to Reed, and she'd be in there watching TV, and she'd look up, and Reed would come walking into the den. And she'd say, "Reed, what are you doing in here?" And he'd say, "Dad's going to sleep again." Those books worked really well. Put the wrong one to sleep, though. So I said, "You know, I like this idea, but this won't work." And it happened 2 or 3 times. So I said, "You know, this really won't work. I'm defeating the wrong purpose." So I said, "I'm going to go out and buy some books that fit my personality that I can work with these kids on." So I went out and looked and picked, and I picked out 2 or 3 books. But one in particular I picked out, and you all know it, but this is a classic, and you all know it. Let me talk to you about it a minute. This book is called The Three Little Pigs. I doubt there's not a person in this room who doesn't know the story of the three little pigs. Classic children's story. We all know the story of that, but real quickly, let's go over it. You know, this mother and father raise 3 little pigs, and there comes a time when she sends them out on their journey in life. They're going to go out just like we have to. When our parents send us out from the home, we go out on the journey of life, and they all go out, and they've got a little bit of money on them. First little pig says, "I'm going to build me a house." He finds a man with a load of straw. And he buys this straw, and he goes over here on a piece of sand, and he starts building his house. And he builds out of straw and builds a nice house. The first thing that comes along, of course, is Mr. Wolf. And Mr. Wolf comes along, and he's a nice guy at first, you know. Knock, 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 you know. And, of course, my wife would make fun of us because here at 12, all of our kids sitting reading me, we all be knocking on the side of the chair. We had a lot of animation with our story reading. You know, knock, 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 little pig, can I come in? Wolf is always friendly at first. And the pig is smart enough, he'd say, you know, "No, no, no, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin." But the wolf wouldn't go away. He'd then get unhappy, and he'd get mad, you know, and he'd start growling, and we'd growl loud and show our teeth, and then he starts huffing and puffing, and we'd huff and puff, and in the pictures in the book, the wolf got big, and his chest got big, and he was getting mad and drooling, and you know, we acted all these out. I won't go through all the animations we did, but we had a good time. I enjoyed this time with my kids because we did this. He did it, you know, and the wolf would start huffing and puffing, and he would blow, and he would destroy the house, and it would blow it down because he had such tremendous wind velocity in his huffing and puffing. little pig barely would get away with his life. Second little pig went out and he says, you know, I'm going to build me a house too. And he found a man with a load of sticks. And he bought that load of sticks, started building him a house. And he built him a house on a load of sticks, and he built it over here on the ground. Built him a house on the ground, out of sticks, and got a beautiful house. Well, his first visitor, of course, Mr. Wolf. Mr. Wolf comes along again. Knock, knock, knock. Little pig, can I come in? And second pig said, no, 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 not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. I'm sure all y'all remember that. So same way, the wolf starts huffing and puffing, and we were huffing and puffing together. And we'd growling and showing our teeth, and like he would, the mean wolf, and he'd blow and blow and blow the house down. The pig would barely escape with his life. Then, you know, we have the third little pig, who's the wise little pig. This little pig goes out, and he says, I'm going to build me a house, but he finds a man with a load of brick. He gets that load of brick and buys it and goes over here on a piece of rock, sets up his brick house on a rock and uses mortar and builds a solid house on a solid foundation. Builds this good house and gets inside it and enjoying it. First man to come along, here comes Mr. Wolf. Knock, knock, knock. Little pig, can I come in? These pig says, no, 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 not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. So here we go again. Wolf was nice at first, then he gets mad and he starts huffing and puffing and blowing and blowing. And he keeps blowing and blowing. He cannot knock the house down because the wise little pig built it out of brick and he built it out of a solid foundation. Couldn't destroy his house. Now hang on to that for a minute. Let's go back to the Sermon on the Mount. Let's go to the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to do this a little bit like I do a law case. I'll have some law cases every now and then. I'll have a case, I'll go to trial, and the judge says, he says, I'm not going to give you my decision today. I'll send it to you in the mail. So we wait 2 or 3 days, and I'll be at my office, and my secretary will come in, and she'll lay that judge's opinion on my desk and say, here's the court ruling on your case. Now, how many of you think that I start off at the front of that page and go through, and it said, these people filed their lawsuit back in January? And no. I flip over to the end. I want to see how the judge ruled. And I go to the back first and see how he ruled. Then I go back out and see why he ruled that way. We're going to do that with Sermon on the Mount. Let's go to the end. Let's see how this thing ends. Go with me to the 7th chapter of Matthew. Let's begin here, 15th verse. Jesus is summarizing up all this wonderful advice he's given us, giving us great advice here in the Sermon on the Mount. Gets over here to Matthew 7, the last chapter. Let's go to verse 15. He starts warning us. I told you all this good stuff. He says, warning us. He says, beware of false prophets. There's going to be people coming to you try to deceive you. He said, they come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Mr. Wolf's going to show up at your doorstep. It's going to be nice. Like these, they come dressed as sheep, but inwardly they're ravening wolves. Wolf's going to come to your doorstep sometime during your life. He's going to come. He's going to be friendly. He may come in the form of somebody offering you easy credit. He may come in the form of somebody that's going to give you a few drugs free to try out. He may come in all sorts of ways. People that work with you, people you have to live with, maybe a family member at times. But the wolf is going to come to your doorstep at some time during your life. Jesus is warning us about that. He's already given us all this good advice, but we're down here at his closing. And he said, the wolf's going to come to your door. And he's going to be friendly at first. He's going to look like a sheep. But inside, he's a raving wolf. So you always have to beware of these false prophets. Gets over here at verse 24. And he said, now, he's finishing up. Remember, he said, we're at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. He said, therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them. If you do what I'm telling you, what I've just taught you about that we're going to talk about in a minute. If you do this, I will liken him unto the wise man which built his house upon a rock. Sounds like the wise little pig, doesn't it? Built his house on a rock. I like the way Luke puts it here in this particular version. Luke, it has the same part, some of the same Sermon on the Mount. And when it gets over here, Luke chapter 6, verse 48, he quotes Jesus like this. He said, I'll show you whom he's like. He's like the man which built a house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. Jesus is telling us we want to be like that third little pig. We want to build our house solid, and we want to build it deep foundation and put it on a rock. Because what happens next? He said, if you build your house on a rock and the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, because it was founded on a rock. The wolf's going to come. He's going to huff and puff, and he's going to blow. And whether he blows your house down depends on how you built it. Did you build your house on a solid foundation, on a rock? Or have you built it out of sticks and straw and built it on sand or dirt? Because he says next, and everyone that heareth these sayings of mine, everybody that hears these sayings that I've just taught you, and doeth them not, shall be likened unto a foolish man, which built his house upon sand. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. Now you notice he talks about great is the fall of the house, not the man. It's important you see that distinction. He's talking here to children of God. He's talking to here those of us that like to believe we have a place reserved for us in heaven. During this lifetime, we're going to have troubles. The wolf is going to come at our door, and he's going to huff and puff, and he's going to blow of it on it. The storms are going to come. And he says, now, if you've done what I told you in Matthew 5, 6, and the first half of 7, if you've done those things, you're going to be able to withstand the storms of this life. That may be alcohol, drugs, sex, addiction, death in the family, financial matters, whatever problems are going to be thrown at you in this life, and you'll have problems, we all do. If you have studied Matthew 5, 6, and half 7, then you'll be able to withstand those storms. If not, then they're going to cause your house to collapse. And it's not talking about eternal salvation. He doesn't talk about the fall of man. He talks about the fall of your house. You're going to go through this life with a lot of trouble. We're all going to have troubles in this life. But if you have studied the Word of God and applied it into your life such that you enter the kingdom of heaven, then you're going to be able to see these storms. You're going to be able to weather these storms. You'll be able to get through them. You have someone close in your family dies, like a spouse or a child or a father or a mother. When those things happen to you, you're going to be like Paul. You're going to grieve, but grieve not as those that have no hope. You'll be able to grieve, but you'll be able to understand the big picture. And that's what Christ teaches us here. You'll be able to understand the problems of this world and how to get through them if you've applied what Jesus has taught us. Okay, we've got this. We know that we need to be like the little pigs that built their house, the wise pig that built his house on a solid foundation. And that's on the word of the Lord. And apply it into our life. Again, your name is in the Lamb's Book of Life, was written there before the foundation of the world. Jesus has given instructions to those of us who are in that situation. He's telling us how to live today and tomorrow. He's not talking about your eternal salvation. He's talking about how to live today and tomorrow and how to survive the problems that we're going to have in this world. He's going to help us overcome those problems, especially if we follow what advice he gives us. Let's go back now to the first of this. And again, I'm not going to cover everything in here, but I want to cover a few highlights. Chapter 5 is where the Sermon on the Mount begins. I want you to look at even the start of this. Go back into the last verse of chapter 4, and it says, that Jesus, talking about Jesus, and there followed him great multitudes of people from Galilee, from Decapolis, from Jerusalem, and from Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. Great multitudes are following him around. He's preaching and doing miracles. He's got a ton of people that are around him. Great congregation to preach to. He's got a captive audience. He's got all these people. He can preach them. And if preaching is what it takes to get you salvation, he's got a great start here, doesn't he? Now go to chapter 5 when we see the Sermon on the Mount. And seeing the multitudes, Jesus sees all these people. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him. He left the multitudes and went up in the mountain. And he preached his great Sermon on the Mount only to a handful of disciples, not to the multitudes. Now, if it takes the gospel being preached to get you to heaven, Jesus turned his back on a lot of people there, didn't he? He turned his back on a lot of people and went up and didn't offer this great sermon to the multitudes. He offered it to his disciples. This sermon doesn't have anything to do with eternal salvation. If it had, why wouldn't Jesus, the greatest preacher of all, preach it to as many people as he could? If this was intended to save everybody eternally, Jesus missed the boat, didn't he? Because he missed the opportunity to save a lot of people's souls. There was a lot of people there that were saved already. And he preached his sermon to his disciples who come and heard him preach. So that's what he did. Seeing the multitudes, he went up and turned his back on all the people, went up into the mountain. And look at this. He even tells us how to preach. He even tells us preachers here. Look at that, at the example he gives us. He went up into the mountain, and when he was set, you know, you return. You know, sometimes when you first start doing this, you get excited, and you know, Kenny and I have talked about how we first started out, and we'd have an hour's worth of preaching because we know that's what it took, and you're through in 15 minutes. Catch you off guard because I'm going so fast and I'm nervous. Jesus tells us here, you come up here, and you get set, and you get people's attention. Jesus gives us a great example here in just this little phrase here. When he was set, then his disciples came up to him. It says here, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, now look, first verse, verse 3, these are called the Beatitudes. These are blessings. Blessings in Latin, Greek, were called Beatus, I believe. I'm not a Greek scholar, but they're called Beatus. That's why they're called Beatitudes. These have to do with our attitudes about life. Jesus, first of all, tells us what our general attitudes ought to be about life. Number one is our attitude about ourselves. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Poor in spirit means blessed are those who are humble. It doesn't mean you're poor. It means that you don't think too highly of yourself. You're poor in your pride and you're poor in your personal spirit. It means you're an humble person. That's the way we approach it. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This whole Sermon on the Mount is about our attitude about ourselves and about life. He starts off with your attitude about yourself. Be an humble person. That's what's going to get you into the kingdom of heaven, is being humble. Look at yourselves first. Next, he goes to 4, 5, and 6, and he's talking about what our attitude ought to be toward the Lord. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for theirs shall be fulfilled. I'm sorry, the next one's about the Lord. This is about sin. Our attitude ought to be about sin. Number one, blessed are they that mourn. He's talking about we all ought to know that we're sinners and we mourn that. We fret over our own sin. If you're an humble person and you're following the Lord, you don't want to sin. We know by our human nature, Apostle Paul tells us we're going to sin, even when we don't want to. Paul said, sometimes I do that stuff that I don't want to do, I do it, and I don't do the things I should do. It's kind of a confusing way he says that, but you can tell. He says, I sin when I'm not trying to, because that's the nature that's in me, and we should mourn that. We should fret. When we realize we're sinners, we ought to drop on our knees and humbly ask the Lord for forgiveness when we sin day to day. Blessed are the meek. The meek doesn't mean you're powerless. Moses was meek. Jesus was meek. But it means power under control. We use that power when we're supposed to use it. We preach with great power and demonstration of the Spirit. You walk out of this pulpit, you ought to be humble. But you ought to be up here strong when you preach the righteousness of Christ. Blessed are they which hunger and thirst after righteousness. I want to come to church. I want to read my Bible because I understand righteousness and what it means to me. And I understand that I need righteousness and I don't have it. I'm a sinner. I'm a poor, wretched sinner. There's nothing, you know, I can't seem to fix that. And I certainly can't get the righteousness that it takes to go to heaven but for Christ. And that's what he's talking about. Next here, 7, 8, 9, he's talking about our attitudes toward the Lord. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Where we get mercies from the Lord. If we show mercy, the Lord will show us mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. How many times you know somebody that's a troublemaker? You know, they're never happy in life. They seem to be happy in their troubles. The Lord tells us we're to be peacemakers. Being peacemakers, always, that ought to be our attitude, and we will see the kingdom of heaven. We'll get to enjoy great peace in our own hearts. 10, 11, 12 are about our attitude toward the world. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. You're going to be persecuted by the world. Oh, you're a church girl. You're one of those hard-shell Baptists. And they'll make fun of us. They'll persecute us because we believe in righteousness. We believe in trying to be righteous. We believe in worshiping the Lord. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you, shall persecute you, shall in all manner of evil say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake, rejoicing, being exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." He tells us our basic attitude about ourselves, about sin, about the Lord, and about the world. We're to be different from the world, and we're not to let people making fun of us bother us because we go to church, because they come in and they find you reading your Bible, because you lead a godly life. People are going to make fun of you because they're going to be people encouraging you to sin and try to make sin look good. That's the very nature of the world. He tells us not to fall for that. Verse 13, "You are the salt of the earth." You're His chosen people. Your name is in the Lamb's Book of Life. He's given you a reservation in heaven. You are the salt of the earth. I'm depending on you to season the earth. I'm seasoning other people. You're the salt and the preservative of the earth. But if the salt has lost its savor, you know, I read this many times, but if the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It's therefore good for nothing but to be cast out and be trodden under the foot of man. If the salt loses its savor, and I struggle with that because I said, does that mean you fall from grace? You lose your savor, you lose your being? Brother Crane straightened me out on that three times. He said, go back and read it again, Don. And I read this thing several times. He said, no, read it word for word. "Ye are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost his savor," doesn't say its, it says his savor. If you're not following what he's told you here, you've lost his savor. And then you're not good for anything. You're not good for help other than to be trodden by man. And again, talking about this world, we're not talking about eternal salvation. We're talking about this world. When you lose your ability to do the things he says, to be honest, to be forthright, to do the things, be humbled and meek, then you've lost his savor. We're to look like Christ. We're to make him our example and to follow in him, his examples. When we do that, we have his savor. But when we lose that, we're no longer the salt of the earth. We might as well throw us down and use this for highway material. "Ye are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, for it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light," he's telling you, you have a light. He's given you a light. "Let your light shine." He didn't say let it shine. It's an important word here. "Let your light so shine." We can all let our light shine. The Lord gives us talents that we can use and do a lot of things for him and for the world. He said, "Let your light so shine before men that they see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." We're to go out and do good works because we are children of God, because we already do have a place in heaven. You're to go out and do good works and let men glorify the Father in heaven. Doing that, the Lord will richly reward you. You'll be able to enjoy this kingdom of heaven. And you say, "Well, Brother Don, my light's real small. I don't have talent. I can't sing. I can't preach. I can't pray. My light is really small." You may have a big candle, Brother Don, but I've got a little birthday candle. And that's what I feel like I got. I got a tiny little birthday candle. It doesn't put out much light. The Lord says, "Let your light shine," whatever that light is. You know, traveling as a kid, we traveled a lot. And I remember riding on with my father and mother and brother and sister in the car. We'd be traveling along and I'd worry that it's going to get dark and our car would break down or something. And my dad would tell me, he said, "No, see that little light over there? That's a farmhouse. We can go there and get help. See, and there's another one." We very rarely did we get where we didn't see a light. And that little light gave me great hope. Raising my kids when they were real little, you know, and you turn the light out in the bedroom, they said, "Can we just have one little light on?" I don't know how many flashlights we burned the batteries out of between Reed and Ray because they wanted that one little light in their bed. One little light provides a lot of hope. You don't know when your light is providing somebody a lot of hope. If I take a birthday candle, a little tiny birthday candle, and I give it to one to Brother Kenny and light it, and I give another one to Brother Randall and one to Brother Dwayne, Sister Sandra, and Brother Jack, and I move around, everybody's little light pretty soon is lighting up this entire room when they're working together for the Lord. And when doing those in the name of the Lord, the Lord richly blesses us and lets us then enjoy this wonderful kingdom of heaven. Let's skip down here again. Let's go down here to verse 23. Well, verse 20 is the heart of the Sermon on the Mount. And that's what he's talking about here. He says, for I say unto you that except your righteousness, he wants us to be righteous. Now, we're sinners, but he wants us to exercise righteousness as best we can. They accept your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Ye shall in no case enter the kingdom of heaven. He's talking about here what Brother Kenny said a while ago when you're singing, what's coming out of your heart. The scribes and the Pharisees, they practiced a lot of righteousness in form. They put on robes and they went to church and they went all the rituals, but they didn't have it in their hearts. That's what he tells us over in the 15th chapter of Matthew. He said, you know, you guys don't have it in your hearts. You say the right things, you do the right things, but you don't love me in your heart. What he wants is us, this is our generation now. This is our kingdom of heaven. Everything comes from the heart. He's put himself in our heart. It's what comes out of your heart. It's what counts. Not what comes out of your mouth, as Brother Kenny said on the singing. What comes out of our heart? He wants our heart in the right place. And that's what the entire Sermon on the Mount is about, getting your heart in the right place. Go to verse 21. Ye have heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. It's one of the basic commandments. Don't kill. And whomsoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. Again, we're talking about timely judgment. But you'll be in danger of judgment. You commit murder, you're going to pay for it right now. But look what he says, verse 22. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, empty-headed, call him a fool, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, you call your brother a fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Again, we're talking about hellfire timely. Sometimes I do stupid stuff, and like we say, I pay for hell for it. That's talking about timely now. I preached one time about there being three different hells, too. One of them is when I get myself in a box here in town, I put myself in hell according to the scriptures when I don't follow him and do this. He's saying this happens when you be angry. Now, murder, you're going to pay judgment, but he says when you're angry, you're committing murder in your heart. And that's what he's telling us. You pay the same judgment for being angry in your heart as openly you would for committing murder. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, if you come to church on Sunday, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against you, if you've got a fight going on with one of your brothers, he said, then leave that altar and go thy way, be reconciled to thy brother, and then come back and offer thy gift. Don't come to church and act righteousness if you've got bitterness in your heart. That's what he's telling us. I'm not talking about eternal salvation. I'm talking about being peaceful with yourself and come and enjoy church and having the great comfort and security that comes in knowing what my Lord has done for me. You get to enjoy that to its fullest. If you don't have any grudges against anybody, if you don't hold any bitterness to anybody, if you've released those, give those to the Lord. That's what he's telling us here. Agree with thine adversary quickly while thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. You're going to pay for that bitterness in this world. The world's going to pay you back for that. If you're bitter here, you're bitter, and you don't agree and get settled with the people that you're enemies with in this world, your friends, or you've got grudges, then those grudges are going to come back to haunt you today. That's what he's telling us here. Verse 27 through 32, I'm not going to go those in details. That's talking about sex and marriage. And again, the Lord has put regulations on sex and marriage. Those regulations are not to keep us from having fun and to punish us. It's to bless the marriage. He's given us those rules and those regulations to bless us, not to hurt us or not to harm us. And we can go over here in John, I believe, John chapter 8, where the adulteress is brought out to him, and he says, you know, let who's without sin cast the first stone, and they all leave, and it says the older ones leave first, and everybody disappears, and Jesus is left alone with adulterers. He says, nobody condemns you, and I don't either. He said, but go and sin no more. He's a great forgiver. It's not like this is unforgivable stuff here. He forgives these type of sins when you violate his regulations in the world. And he's telling us, gives us great instructions here, and I encourage you, I'm not going to cover everything, but you need to go read the Sermon on the Mount. You ought to read it, I'd say at least annually, because it'll remind you of the way that we need to be acting in this world. Go to verse 33. Again, I have heard it said of old, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. And this gets a little confusing to people about, does this mean swearing and cussing? No, it's not. Doesn't mean that, but you shouldn't do that either. Shouldn't use a rough word. You especially shouldn't use the Lord's name in vain. But he said, I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven nor for God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is a footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is a city. Neither shall thou swear by thy head, because thou cannot make one hair black or white. Now, what's he saying? I swear to you by every hair on my head. I swear to you on my mother's grave. If I want somebody to know I'm telling the truth, have the reputation for telling the truth. You don't swear. I swear to God I'm telling the truth. I swear to this. I'm swear. Now, you know, I know I practice this law. We make people swear on the Bible because that's a legal proceeding and that has civil and criminal impact. That's how you make people put them under the law. There has to be a statute that says you have to adjure people, as we say. You have to put them under an oath. Then what you say, you can't be held. I can lie right now and you can't hold it against me. You put me under oath and I lie and I'm committing perjury. Lord says, you shouldn't have to go to all that. Tell the truth. He said, that's what he tells us here. Let your communications be yes and no, for whosoever is more than these cometh of evil. You know, us lawyers are real good about giving you an answer and not telling you what we said. We talk around it. Don't make up a trick answer. Be honest with people. Let your communications be honest. Yes and no. Answer them correctly. Don't beat around the bush. Don't use trick questions to get around talking to people and giving them the right answers. Verse 38, ye have heard it said of old, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You go back in the Old Testament, that was put in place because people were giving punishment that was greater than the crime. You'd hit me on the arm and I'd cut off your head. Those two don't match up. That's what he's saying. That's what that law was written for, so that the punishment would fit the crime. Still a good law today, but people were misinterpreting it. They were using it for vengeance. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn the other cheek. Again, he gets out of their attitude, their heart. People were taking that Old Testament saying and using it for vengeance. Later on, he tells us, vengeance doesn't belong to us anyway. It belongs to him. He gets over in verse 44. He said, well, verse 43, thou shalt have heard, you've heard it said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. Pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Well, that's hard to do, isn't it? If I don't love my enemy, if I have somebody I disagree with, I don't love them, I don't pray for them, you know what I'm doing? I'm building my house out of sticks and on the sand. I'm not building it on the solid foundation. The Lord tells us we should pray for our enemies. What's going on over the Middle East? You think, I can't pray for those guys. Yeah, you can, and you should. You should pray that the Lord will enter their hearts and guide them and direct them, as we do all our leaders of our country, as we do everyone, all even your enemies. You got a complaint against somebody or a gripe or a grudge you've been holding forever, pray for them. It'd be amazing what that'll do to your heart. If you pray for him and do what the Lord tells us here so that we can be wise like the wise pig. He says, if you just pray and if you just love people around you, if we're just good to people I come to church with, he said, even the publicans do that. That's what the Pharisees do. They just love the people that are with them. We're to love those people out. We're to take care of those people out in the street. I've spoken here before about, you know, cast your bread upon the waters. Who do we give to and who do we contribute to? You take care of people out on the street that the Lord puts in front of you. You take care of others. You go out and be with sometimes Jesus, what Jesus did. He went out and was surrounded himself with people who I'm not sure I'd invite to church. That's who he went out to see and went out to get. That's what he says. Take yourself out beyond your comfort zone. Don't just love your family. Love other people and help other people. Get in here in chapter 6. Number 1, he tells us about almsgiving. How do we give to the poor? How do we give to church? How do we give to charity? Well, I want to go give a big amount, and I want it in the paper so I can get my name on a building somewhere or I can get my name listed that I gave to this charity. You know, when I do that, I get my reward because everybody saw. I saw your name in the paper, and you gave this to charity. He said, don't do that. Now, that's fine. He's not saying don't give to charity and like we normally do, and sometimes your name gets listed. But he's saying the real important giving comes from the heart. You don't go try to get attention to it. He said, when you give your alms, when they'll do it, do not sound the trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do on the streets. They have their reward. when I give to charity and I take it as a big tax deduction and I get my name in a program somewhere, I'm getting the reward. I'm getting a world reward. He said, but that's not what you need if you want the kingdom of heaven. He said, "Don't when you give us alms, don't let the left hand know what the right hand doing, that thine alms may be secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly." You know, every now and then we'll get, the Diggins will meet, and we'll have gotten a gift to the church, a substantial amount of money. Well, who gave it? Well, we don't know. It was given privately or secretly. What do we do when we get a gift like that? Thank the Lord. Remember, let your light so shine that other men see your work, and the Lord gets all the glory for it. They'll glorify the Father which is in heaven. There's nothing wrong. You know, we all give to charities, and we'll all do it quietly and secretly. But a lot of times the Lord says the ones you're really blessed for are when you do it privately and secretly. He sees it, and he's the one that counts. And when we do that, we see that we get to enjoy the kingdom of heaven. And likewise, then he says, let's talk about praying now. He said, you ever seen your people on the streets? And I know you've had a few in Lubbock. I've seen them in other towns, especially New York City. There's all sorts of preachers on the street corner, and they're out preaching, trying to save souls. And he said, they get what they're after. They get the attention that they're after. He said, when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites that love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets. Verily I say to you, they have their reward. They're getting the reward they want. But he said, basically, go in the closet. He means go into the chamber, closed chamber, which could mean in your heart. You could be sitting there and you're praying in secret to the Father, and he sees it secretly, but he rewards you openly. He's not speaking against public prayer, but I can promise you, when I hear someone praying and it touches me, I'm going, that person knows how to pray, and they practiced a lot to themselves. They practiced a lot privately. They've done a lot at home praying. Some of your best public prayers are given by those people because you can tell who they're praying to and who they're praying for. He said, the Father already knoweth what you need before you ask him, but he wants it to come from the heart. And he wants you to do it for him, not for some other glory you may get in the world. Because then he says, look, after this manner, therefore we pray you. He doesn't say pray this exact prayer and repeat it. He says, after this manner. And y'all all know this. They call it the Lord's Prayer. It's not really the Lord's Prayer. Lord's Prayer is over there in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus prayed. That's the Lord. This is really our prayer, the disciples' prayer, I guess you could call it. The Lord, he said, and y'all know this, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. The kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debt as we forgive our debtors. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Let's go back and look at that prayer real quick. How many times is the word I or me in there? Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. You know, it's a family prayer. It's a prayer for everybody. Collective prayer. I like that. It's a collective prayer. That's the manner that we're to pray. Now, I know there's nothing wrong with it. We're told to ask what we need sometime, and we do ask. But we should always ask, thy will be done. You notice that's one of the key things in there. Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. We all should pray that then, Lord, let me see your will and let me be submissive to what your will is. You notice in what he comes back and repeats, verse 14 and 15. For if you forgive men their trespasses, after all this prayer about how we should pray, he comes back and says, let me emphasize one more thing. Forgiveness. If you don't forgive somebody, the Lord won't forgive you. And again, we're not talking about sending you to hell, not eternal hell. We're talking about in this world. You follow these things, you say prayer, you forgive men. When you get in trouble, people are going to forgive you. Unless you're like me, you're going to get yourself in trouble. If ye forgive not men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. We're talking about timely. Came away with fasting. Moreover, when you fast. Fasting is one of those things we don't do much and talk about much. I've tried it on occasions, and it's good for us, and we should do it, and it'll get rid of some problems that we otherwise couldn't get rid of. The Lord tells us that later on. Excuse me. But he says, when you fast, we should fast. You think, well, I don't know how to fast. None of us know how to fast. We fashion fast after ourselves. Quick and easy one is give up animal products. That means meats, fish, chicken, poultry, milk products. Drink water, eat fruits, nuts, and vegetables. You can do that for a day. Now, the biggest problem you have is all up here. I think I gotta go eat. Try it for a day, but now don't go out and try it because you want to lose weight. That's a diet. Don't go out and try it because you want to prove a point to somebody else. That's a protest. Do it because you want to commune with the Lord. That's a fast. Do it in which you think, oh, I'm not going to eat today. I'm going to do this. I'm going to carry me some fruits and vegetables and nuts and a bottle of water and put it in my car. And I'm going to go down over lunch hour and I'm going to sit in my car. I'm going to pray. Try that. It works. You feel close to the Lord when you're doing that. When you have denied yourself those things of the world that you'd like to have, I sure could use a dessert right now. I could have had a piece of pie, something like that. Try that for a day. It's a struggle, more than you realize, because it's all up here. The devil's going to counteract you. But it says, when you do that, he said, don't let other people know you're fasting. Disguise yourself. Don't do it that you're trying to let people see you. It's one of the things I have when we have that season of Lent every year. People say, oh, I'm going to give up this for Lent, and they make a big deal out of it. They're doing it to get attention from other people. Nothing wrong with fasting, and I encourage you to do it, but do it when you're in secret, and your Father, which sees you in secret, shall reward thee openly. Jump over to 24 of Matthew 6. Let me move along here quickly. No man can serve two masters. He tells us this between the Lord and the world. I want to go serve in the world. It's so much fun out there, isn't it? I want to go to football games. I want to put that in my top priority, and work is my priority. And I want to do other things and go to movies. I don't want to go to church. I can't go to church in the morning because I stayed out too late on Friday night. I've got a different master when I start acting like that. He's saying here, you're either going to love one and hate the other. You've got to choose between the Lord and the world. You think, well, I want to eat, and I want to have clothes to wear. I want to do all those things that you have fun in life. And he said, I know that. I know you want all these things in the world. Put me first, and I'll give you everything you need, and that always includes more than we need. He gives us some fun times. He tells us, which one of you by taking thought can add one cubit unto his stature? And he gets over here later and he says, how can you if you worry about these things, how does that get you anything at all? Father knows what you need. He's going to give it to you. He tells us here, look at the lilies of the field, how I decorate them. I put great clothes on them. I give food to the fowls in the air. Even Solomon, in all his wonderful clothing, wasn't as beautiful as the Lord gives many of the flowers in the field. Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which is today is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you? O you of little faith, therefore take no thought of what you shall eat or what you shall drink or where you shall be clothed. For after all these things the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knoweth that you have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. He's not saying don't work for a living, don't do all those other things. Put him first. I talk to the kids sometime, and I try to use a visual demonstration on this, but put him first. You know, I go about the world, the first thing I do in the morning, I want to get up and I want to watch ESPN, Sports Center, and see what the top 10 sports plays were. And I want to watch a little news, and I want to read my newspaper, you know, and then I want to go to work, and I'll think, I'll read the Bible at the end of the day. Well, you know where I am at the end of the day? I'm dog tired, and I've gotten tied up, and I get there, and then suddenly I hadn't had time to read the Bible like I should. Hadn't had time to pray because I've had a tough day. Lord says, put me first. Sometimes in mornings when I haven't had time to read the Bible, I went, no, Don, stop. Let me just take a few minutes and read the Bible. Let me take a few minutes and stop and pray for my family, my children, my church family, for those that stand in need of prayer. Let me take time to do that. You know, when I do that, it's amazing how much better my day goes. It's amazing how much more I get done. You know, I'm pretty prophetic. If I got a bad day, I don't have time to read the Bible, I can guarantee you I have a bad day. And I'm going to have a bad day. But when I start off reading the Lord's Word and thinking about it and praying, my day's a lot better. And I start off in a lot better mood. Put Him first, everything else in this world will fall into place, including all those things you want and like to have. I do that. I have time to watch TV. I have time to eat. I have time to be able to afford some clothes on my back. That's what He's telling us when He says, seek first the kingdom of God. Last chapter now. Judge not that you be judged, because whatever judgment you judge with, you're going to be judged with that yourself. He's talking about in this world. If I judge every people, if I talk about it all the time to other people, people are going to use that same standard to judge me. And He said here, if you see the beam, you see the mote in the other person's eye, the little speck in their eye, you don't know it, but you've got a huge beam in your eye. You know, we're all sinners. And I can find somebody in here, I won't embarrass anybody, but I can find somebody and say, they've got this sin, and I want to point it out when I've got the sin myself. First of all, you should take the beam out of your own eye, look at yourself and see your own sin. Recognize what a sinner we are ourselves. Then my eyes are clear to see the sin of other people. We've got to do a little judging in this world. He's not saying you can't judge people. We have to make judgments on who we allow to come in the church. We have to make judgments every day on who we hire. There are things that we do like that. He gives us our intellectual ability to make certain judgments in this world. But He's talking about sin nature. And don't hold stuff against other people that you don't want to be held to the same standard. I have to be careful about judging somebody. And I may be lucky because you don't know my sin. So you can't judge me, but especially I shouldn't judge somebody for the same sin that I've got and I just don't want to talk about. We've all got those feelings in our heart that we may judge somebody else again because I hadn't done it publicly. But remember over there, what I feel in my heart is just as bad as doing stuff physically. Be careful about how we judge people. Don't be like the hypocrites. He tells us here not to cast our pearls for swine or cast what's holy unto the dogs. See, this used a lot because you find people that will try to use their religious standing. They're more righteous than now, more holier than they are to try to make yourself look good with them. They're going to be criticized for their holier than thou attitude. You know, we've seen sometimes people run for public office, and politics is the worst place to try to mix your religion. You see these people that try to be religious and run for public office. All you're doing is it's going to cause the news media and all the critics of the world to criticize your religion. If I get out there and run for office, then what they're going to be criticizing my religion if I run on my religion. Don't cast your pearls before swine. It doesn't say go out there and not let people know you're a righteous person. But, there are some people out there that are not children of God. Apostle Paul tells us that in 1 Corinthians 2:14. The natural man does not receive things of the Spirit. They're foolishness to him. You can go out and argue with a foolish person all day long and you're not ever going to convince them, and you're casting your pearls before swine. Until the Lord has touched their heart, you're not going to change them. They're still going to be a dog in that sense. Go over here, verse 12, and He gives us the golden rule, which is a great rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Don't do anything to anybody else that you wouldn't have them do unto you. Very good basic rule of life. Verse 13, enter ye at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be that go thereat. Now, the wide gate is a fun one to go down in. That's the fun of the world. Everybody, goes it. Everybody's doing this. You might as well, too. Let's all go out here and let's go out and what we would call sin. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Everybody's got their own thoughts, and all of them are right. Let's go out and be like the world because everybody's doing it. And He says here, and many there are that go thereat, because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life. You're in this kingdom of God, and few there be that find it. But the rewards therein are great. Then He goes on and concludes like we did. Now, if you want to do these things and enjoy the kingdom of heaven, you need to be like the wise little pig. Follow what the Lord teaches here, and when you do, you are building your foundation. You're digging it deep, and you're building a solid foundation and a solid house. And when the storms of life come along, they're not going to bother you. They're not going to blow down your house. They're certainly not going to bother you. That's not what this is talking about eternally. But you're going to be able to live through the problems of this world. And those that don't are going to have problems in this world. I want to conclude with I'll finish with this over in John 13. After Jesus finished washing the feet of his saints, again, where he's given instructions on how to live in this world and the things to do. And one of the things he tells them about washing each other's feet, because it keeps us humble, makes us go through forgiveness. Verse 17 of John 13, he says, "If ye know these things, happy are ye if you do them." Now, there's two ifs there. If you know these things, there's an if of knowledge. If you know them, if you're aware of them, how do you know these things? There's a great blessing in knowing what he's telling you. You need to read the book. You need to read the book. You need to read the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus and start there. Read the book of Proverbs, as Brother George always used to tell us to. You need to read. There's a great blessings in knowledge. And that's what he's telling us here. If you know these things, if you know what I'm trying to teach you, you got to know it first. And there's a great blessing in that. Then he says, happy are ye if you do them. Another if. First if was on knowledge. This if is on performance. There's a blessing in knowing them, and the only way you're going to know them is to read this book. Second blessing is happy are ye if you do them. You're going to be happy in this world if you'll do what Jesus teaches us here in this book, especially the Sermon on the Mount. We serve a wonderful master. He has secured us a place in heaven regardless of whether we follow his will all the times or not. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have something in your heart which tells me you're a child of God. Your name is in that Lamb's Book of Life. It won't be erased or taken out. But you can enjoy this world right now, today and tomorrow, and be happy if we do what he tells us to do in this book. You've been very kind with your attention, and my prayer is that the Lord will richly bless each one.